Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We cover all aspects of the Great War and have around 6,000 members. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 1st of March 2025, and this is episode 350. On today's programme, I speak to historian Mark Jones about the learning curve in the 1st 12th Battalion London Regiment, also known as the Rangers, on the Western Front during the Great War. Mark explores how this territorial battalion adapted, learned and transformed amidst the harsh realities of the Western Front from their deployment in late 1914 up until the beginning of the Battle of the Somme in 1916. Mark spoke to me from his home in England. Mark, welcome to the podcast. Before we get stuck into the subject, could you tell me how you became interested in this topic?
Well, thank you very much for having me on, first and foremost. It's a really interesting question with not a particularly simple answer, unfortunately, as I imagine is often the case. So I think in terms of kind of an interest in the First World War, that came to me quite late in life, really. So I'd always had this interest in history and an interest in military history in particular. But yeah, with the First World War, it was something that came, I didn't really come to until sort of my late 20s, effectively. So growing up, I sort of had grandparents who'd lived through the Second World War, but that kind of experience and knowledge of the First World War wasn't there. I certainly didn't have any living relatives from that period. I'm sure there must have been conversations in their own childhood about their, you know, their parents' experiences of the First World War, but that didn't percolate its way back down to me. And likewise, it wasn't something that was covered particularly strongly in school either. I can't remember who made the exact quote, but this idea that actually most English, you know, English school children learned about the First World War from their English teachers rather than their history teachers. Well, I learned it from neither, because I think I'm the only one of a handful of people who didn't do the war poets in school, which, yeah, feels like, so it felt like a sort of a big gap in my knowledge, I think, in regards to the First World War. And likewise, even though I had a really strong interest in history, that opportunity to potentially pick up this work in at university or something like that didn't happen, because I didn't go on to study history. I studied archaeology on the advice of my history teacher, so read into that what you will. Had a very enjoyable few years doing archaeology, but obviously very little First World War within that, unfortunately. And so it wasn't really until the centenary came around and there was this sort of this big explosion of public work and awareness around the First World War, and it's really started to get me thinking about my own family's history with the conflicts. Again, sort of from a sort of genealogical perspective, I already had relatives who'd spent a lot of time going through the family history, but noticeably none of them have really looked in any detail at that kind of First World War generation, if you like. And so I was keen to really kind of look into that. It was really on the back of that kind of research and understanding how extensive and what an impact that the war had on my family, that really started to gain me interest in trying to find out a bit more and sort of reading, and sort of in a roundabout way ultimately led to me doing my master's at Birmingham. And yeah, sort of looking at a topic that specifically looked at the First World War. Is that good? Is it, how is that? That's quite a long introduction, but hopefully gives you an idea of sort of the kind of the long and winding path towards the First World War and the Rangers,
which is a great segue into my next question. So who exactly were the Rangers and how did you become interested in this unit?
So I'll answer this in reverse order, if that's quite all right. So I think the honest answer is, why did I become interested in the Rangers? It very much comes down to London Pride, the conference that you hosted and I was lucky enough to be a contributor to, in the sense that I had this sort of background interest in the territorial force. When London Pride was starting to be advertised and you were looking for contributors, I was looking at it and thinking, I'd love to be part of that. I'd love to kind of be engaged with that. But actually, you know, I don't have a personal connection particularly to the London Regiment or even the Territorial Force for that matter. So, you know, where's that connection going to be? And so what I started to do is to look at what I was thinking of doing in terms of a dissertation for my master's and trying to see where the overlaps were. And within the dissertation itself, I was really keen to look at 1915. It's one of those sort of understudied periods of the First World War. I take into account it's still the First World War, so there's, you know, a significant historiography there. It's not a complete, like a forgotten element of the conflict by any standards. But also sort of looking at military innovation studies, and particularly how units, and particularly small units or battalion and brigade size, are going about that process of learning from their experiences and trying to make changes and kind of incrementally get better at what they're doing, I guess. And so while looking at that and looking at the units that I was potentially going to be assessing as part of that dissertation, I was keen to have a look at sort of what the links were with the Territorial Force and then what were the links with the London Regiment. And as it turns out, the 28th Division, one of the units I was looking at the time, had a, you know, a number of different regiments associated with the London Regiments who were part of the division at various different times. And I think the Rangers really stood out for a couple of different reasons, I guess. I mean, first and foremost, I think the fact they have a name title, you know, rather than being sort of the 8th Middlesex or something like that, I think that really stood out. It's like, well, that's interesting. I wonder why they called themselves the Rangers. And certainly then sort of looking into their war diaries, understanding that they'd had a really interesting war, and also as we're going through it, sort of discovering this sort of second life, if you like, with the 56th Division from 1916 onwards, suddenly really, yeah, sort of got the kind of historian creative juices flowing and got me thinking, well, actually, this is something which could be really interesting to look at. And it's a kind of an element of kind of my wider interest, which allows me to kind of really go into some granular detail about a particular unit and what their experience was like in this period. So that's where the interest in the Rangers came from. In terms of kind of the Rangers and who they were and what their history was, again, it's interesting, but also in some ways very typical of the kind of the wider London Regiment experience. So if you go back to the 1860s, the battalions originally formed as the 40th Middlesex Rifle Volunteer Corps, around a time when lots of these different volunteer corps regiments were popping up across the UK, largely on the back of kind of the perceived threats of France. And really, as time kind of progresses over that Victorian period, these units kind of change and mutate and develop into different units. They kind of expand, they contract, they merge, they're disbanded. And luckily, in the case of the Rangers, they actually have a fairly continuous history throughout this period. So initially, they, as I've said already, they're formed as part of the Middlesex Rifle Volunteer Corps. By the time Haldane's reforms come around in the early 20th century, they form part of the new London Regiment as its 12th County of London Battalion. The Rangers title itself kind of comes from, again, from their very early history. So again, whilst they were known as a unit of the Middlesex Rifle Volunteer Corps, they also went by their kind of more commonly known title as the Central London Rangers, or Rifle Rangers, to actually give them their full title. And their history is quite interesting in the sense of their kind of their demographics and kind of who made up the battalion. Because when you look across the London Regiments, and I appreciate I'm telling you stuff you know already, and I'm sure but many of your listeners know already as well, Tom, but you get this real mixture of where you have sort of very localized battalions, kind of similar to what we see elsewhere across the wider territorial force, where people from a local community will be coming together to either form a company or a battalion of that particular territorial force regiments. And then you get the other extreme, particularly within the London Regiment as well, where you have more sort of class-based regiments, you know, so where it's where regiments come together with people based on shared experiences, educational backgrounds, their working life, as well as the kind of very much white-collar units. And the Rangers kind of transcend elements of both of this. So they're kind of, their very early history is very much in that white-collar fashion. They are primarily made up of staff within the legal profession in central London, but noticeably people who are not part of the Inns of Court. So very often not barristers or solicitors or lawyers, but usually the kind of the supporting elements of that. So people like clerks and things like that. So still very much white collar, but much more on the working end of white collar workforce. As time goes on, they also start to kind of draw in other elements as well. So probably the two most significant are, firstly, the relationship the battalion has with Beckton Gasworks, and to the extent where they actually form a company from the staff and workforce of Beckton Gasworks, but then also their link with the Regent Street Polytechnic University as well, which exists today as Westminster University, and again forming a sort of a polytechnic company within the wider battalion. And so they have this kind of really interesting mixed history where they kind of sit astride these kind of two extremes that you tend to find within the Territorial Force. And like many other Territorial Force regiments, they get that opportunity to see some active service, particularly during the Boer War. And they contribute volunteers. They also contribute to the Imperial Yeomanry as well. And so as we get towards 1914 and kind of the immediate prelude to the First World War, it's an interesting battalion that is, yeah, very sort of typical of the wider London regiment, but also has some kind of interesting some interesting elements of its own as well.
Listeners, the cat has arrived and she wants to be involved in the interview.
I don't
Right,
blame her.
so yeah, the Rangers are fascinating, especially with those companies which are formed at the Beckton Gas Works, famous for the one of the scenes in Full Metal Jacket, apparently,
Indeed.
and the Poly Company, which is a polytechnic, Upper Regent Street now, where the BBC building is based. Now we're going to talk about the learning curve or learning process, which is a great topic for First World War historians. And what's interesting about what you're doing, you're looking at it in the first, I suppose, half of the war, which I think is really an area which is not covered. So looking at that, what does the experience of the 1st 12th Rangers London Regiment reveal about the British Expeditionary Force's ability to learn and adapt during the early years of the First World War?
So I think this is a really interesting question, and as you kind of said in your introduction to that question, very much kind of an understudied period. I think when we look at sort of, while the subject of a learning curve is a really significant one within studies of the First World War, what we tend to find in terms of the historiography is it tends to split into kind of two different areas. Kind of first and foremost, you have kind of 1914 and beforehand, and particularly that period between sort of the Boer War and the First World War, where there have been some fantastic studies. So people like Spencer Jones, Mark Connolly, Tim Bowman, who have really kind of dug into the Edwardian Army and its kind of process of how it develops in both in terms of kind of technological and tactical change, but also its kind of how its organizational culture and structure kind of evolved during that period. And then, if we like, we have the kind of the classic debate around the learning process or the learning curve, depending what your predilection is, which is a debate in itself. And let's not dive into that here, otherwise this is going to be a very long podcast. But essentially, what's really interesting with this period is it kind of is almost very much bookended either by the 100 Days campaign, the end of 1918, or Battle of the Somme in 1916, and everything between those kind of two periods. And what tends to kind of fall through the gap then is what is happening towards the end of 1914, as the kind of the original BEF is starting to become bogged down in trench warfare. And then what happens over 1915 as well, which I think is overshadowed for a number of reasons. I mean, first and foremost, you have the kind of the drama of 1914 and the initial campaign and the sort of the breaking of the tension that's been building up in Europe for so long. And then you have the birth of really heavily industrialized warfare from 1916 onwards, and the onset of the kind of the Powers Divisions and Citizens' Armies, and this kind of fundamental restructuring of the British Army in this period. And so 1915 kind of sits uncomfortably between those kind of two elements. But nonetheless, there's a lot of really interesting stuff that happens. Not least that there has to be this process where the army goes from being its pre-war small professional force through to this mass citizens army that's going to kind of come to the fore over the latter years of the war. And I suppose I was really interested to kind of understand what happens in that period. And what's really noticeable from my perspective, at least, is that we start to see a much more formalized approach to both training, but also the approach to learning as well, and moving away from fairly ad hoc existence through, like, prior to 1914, and indeed throughout most of 1915 as well. Whereas by the beginning of 1916, we're starting to see an army which is taking a much more structured, regimented approach to how it's learning lessons and disseminating knowledge throughout the wider BEF. And also, at the same time, the BEF has become much better at adapting to its circumstances as well, as very much based on its own experiences and, and the losses and the kind of the terrible tragedies that occur across 1915 are very instrumental. how those lessons are learned and how effectively they've learned is a slightly different issue. And very often the army's having to kind of almost relearn some of the lessons that I first came across in late 1914 and 1915. But nonetheless, it is, in my opinion, at least, a kind of a really important transformative period for the British Army. So, yes, that's where the interest lies. And I think that's why this period is kind of so particularly interesting.
Yeah, I would agree with that, because it's very localized and there's no sort of central planning. Oh, I could stand corrected on that. But in terms of, you know, it's very much done ad hoc by people in units rather than having a centralized bureaucracy that we get later in the war, which is the interesting thing. So on that question, how effective was the pre-deployment training of the Rangers? How useful was this in preparing them for the challenges of trench warfare that they discover on the Western Front?
So this again is, I think, a really interesting question, because in some respects, the Rangers have quite an unusual pre-war existence. So, although, again, maybe not untypically for the wider London Regiment. So when war breaks out, they're actually physically on the train on their way to their annual camp at Wool. So this is sort of, war breaks out, they're on the train, the train turns around, they go back to London and suddenly begin this process of kind of preparing for deployments. And initially, at least, this is very much kind of focused around a kind of a very traditional approach to training. So lots of drill, lots of route marches, and some very minor tactical exercises, but very often these are being conducted in London itself. So in sort of various open spaces and green parks and the like, where they're trying to kind of do this. At the same time, they're taking on a huge number of new recruits as well. So it creates a kind of a very staccato effect, I suppose, in terms of training, where they're kind of trying to kind of build this unit cohesion, but at the same time, actually working with people with very different levels of experience and knowledge around very basic military skills very often as well. And so it's not really until they get that opportunity to kind of leave London and kind of go to various different training camps across the southeast of England, where they're able to really expand on this in more detail and start to kind of undertake that more incremental training as they kind of go from, you know, section through to platoon to company to battalion. And even on one occasion, actually a brigade level exercise to be able to kind of operate in a manner which will allow them to deploy overseas. There are a lot of complexities within this as well, which makes life a lot more difficult. I mean, first and foremost, training, certainly prior to 1914 within the Territorial Force, very much lies in the hands, first and foremost, with the general officer commanding that particular Territorial Force division and how involved they are in training, but also then when it comes down to individual battalion and company commanders and the training they're undertaking. Now, they're supported in this endeavour by the various members of permanent staff, including the battalion adjutants, who will all be drawn from the regular army. But certainly as 1914 progresses, that kind of pool of experienced regular staff disappears very quickly. They're recalled to their battalions at the outbreak of war in many cases. Certainly older permanent staff who aren't going back to their battalions are going into various different training establishments to start training the kind of the waves of new recruits that are coming on the back of kind of Kitchener's call for volunteers. And so this kind of institutional knowledge within the battalion disappears quite rapidly. Even with, and add to that the influx of new recruits and everything, that makes that very difficult. On top of that, there's also this requirement for many units within the Territorial Force to be undertaking various different taskings while they're going through this process of training. So, you know, so we've mentioned Becks and Gasworks already. I mean, within days of kind of being called up, members of the Rangers are already going to defend the gasworks against the risk of German saboteurs, which doesn't happen, but as you can imagine, it's still taking soldiers, and particularly in this case trained soldiers, out of the battalion and into these various different locations on what were deemed as kind of really important tasks, but also has that really negative effect on developing training. Likewise, even as they're kind of going through these kind of wider incremental training exercises across the southeast, they disappear for the best part of 2 months because they're called upon to defend the London and Southwest Main Line. So you've got sort of small groups of Rangers kind of dotted along the railway over many, many miles with absolutely no opportunity for training. And in fact, this is when they actually take their first casualty, when the poor rifleman gets hit by a train in the siding when he wasn't looking. And all of this has a kind of a real knock-on effect on that kind of cohesion and that effectiveness. And it's really only in the kind of the weeks before they deploy to France where they have that kind of very short window of opportunity to not only to kind of sort of form companies and sort of do that kind of company level training, but actually also kind of get used to new equipment as well. So it's at this time when they're issued their new Lee Enfield rifles and their new webbing and things like that as well. And that, yeah, it's not an ideal circumstance to be in before deploying to France, and particularly not knowing what their task is going to be when they arrive in France as well.
And I suppose on top of that, there's a whole sort of issue of physical training that you get a lot of office workers, especially in the poly company, and you're trying to integrate a lot of new individuals into existing structures because a lot of these units, I don't know about the Rangers, were under strength in 1914.
Yeah, exactly. So I haven't been able to find sort of an exact strength of the Rangers, but certainly they were capable of taking on a significant number of recruits, so which I think implies at least that they certainly had vacancies. I think one of the really interesting things, particularly for the Territorial Force in this time as well, is infantry training 1914, which is one of these really important kind of doctrinal documents that the army publishes around the development of infantry training. For the army in 1914, unsurprisingly. But one of the things that comes off the back of this is the restructuring of an infantry battalion from eight companies down to four. Most of the Territorial Force hadn't undertaken this process before the war broke out. However, they would need to do this before they deployed to France. So not only are you integrating new people into companies, but then you're also having to kind of merge companies as well. And so there's the logistical burden of that. There's also what I would also say is the interpersonal burden of that as well, about, sort of how do you tell one company commander he's going to be commanding one of the four new companies, and what happens to that other one? Likewise, what does that mean for your senior NCOs? How do you kind of keep that kind of camaraderie and spirit that was so often the case in many of these territorial individual companies. In one sense, I suspect the Rangers were probably more fortunate than most, in the sense that they have a single drill hall. They're not sort of territorially affiliated like so many territorial force battalions are. So some of those structures are probably aren't quite as embedded as they would be, for example, in a more rurally based battalion, for example, where, people would probably only see other members of the battalion at annual training, and otherwise everything was done within that particular drill hall and a particular company or platoon or squadron or whatever that would be. So to an extent, perhaps the Rangers were a little bit luckier in that, but it doesn't take away from the fact there's a huge amount that's having to happen in a short space of time. And it's I think it's a real credit actually to the Territorial Force that they're able to achieve so much in such uninspired circumstances very often.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I think just before we get on to organizational culture and leadership, could you just give us a bit of background of when did the Rangers go to France and what do they do in France up until they join the 56th Division in sort of early 1916?
Yeah, absolutely. So they arrive in France on sort of on Christmas Day 1914, which has been fantastic for them to be stuck in Le Havre on Christmas Day. So what happens is that they land, and at this kind of point in time, it's the usual process for a newly arrived Territorial Force battalion to be attached directly to General Headquarters for kind of additional. It isn't the phrase isn't used, but effectively remedial training to prepare them to be able to enter the front line. This is actually abolished by February 1950 because actually just the kind of the rate of attrition means you just need to get battalions there as quickly as possible. And so it's something like for the first 16 battalions that actually make their way over to the first 16 Territorial Force battalions, I should say, who actually enter France, they actually only average something like 20 days of training under GHQ before they're sent into the front lines. The Rangers are a little bit more fortunate than that. They actually spend about 44 days with General Headquarters before they enter the front line. And so what happens to the Rangers after they've kind of had this initial training period? And again, a lot of this training is replicating what they've already done in the UK. There's a little bit more of a focus on what I would refer to as operational training. So for example, they have a lecture about how to stay concealed from aircraft, which, as far as I'm aware, they hadn't had the opportunity to do beforehand. Likewise, they have a lecture from the Royal Engineers about the latest practices in entrenchment. So there is certainly some element of trying to prepare them for the conditions they face. However, much of that training is very much on the back of what they were already doing both before the war and then certainly during those kind of early months in the UK as well. So having done that, they're then assigned to the 28th Division, who we'll come back to in more detail later. But to give a very quick overview of the 28th Division, it's despite its relatively high number, it's actually a regular division. It's drawn from mostly battalions coming back from India, but also some coming from places like sort of like my mind's gone blank. That's typical China. That was the word I was looking for. So, for example, you see, they get quite a lot of the Chinese, like the Chinese battalions, which have come over quite late. And so it's, as we'll kind of see a little bit later, they're really sort of having to deal with a very new, that division itself is having to deal with a very new structure. I mean, these aren't pre-war brigades and pre units that were used to serving alongside each other pre-war. It's very much a kind of an amalgam of different units from different parts of the empire coming together and trying to form a new unit. And so the division itself has only been in the front line a matter of weeks by the time the Rangers join them. And during this period, for the most part, the Rangers are involved in a kind of variety of different fatigue duties. So lots of carrying, lots of trench digging. They get some opportunity to do some kind of spend some time in the trenches alongside their regular counterparts. And again, this is something I think we'll pick up a little bit more later. But certainly much of their experience is between the lines, I suppose, in one sense. So between the kind of the rear areas and between the front line and the very kind of very unglamorous but also very dangerous activities of actually trying to get supplies into what are often very rudimentary trench systems. And again, the 28th Division and the Rangers are both based in and around the Ypres salient, which is particularly unpleasant at this point in the war of 1915. It's the trenches are very poorly constructed very often. It's wet. Very often in the personal accounts, you're reading about the division and these various units taking over trenches from the French army, which as English soldiers often are very sort of disparaging about, but then also sort of some like really quite unsanitary conditions they're coming to, both in terms of the amount of water, but also sort of the corpses of French soldiers within trenches and things like that as well. So it's a really grim introduction to the Western Front. So, and this is how it continues really right up until the Second Battle of Ypres, when the great sort of German gas offensive takes place. The Rangers are kind of called into the line very rapidly, and over the kind of the course of the fighting, and particularly at the Fressenberg Ridge, the battalion is effectively not wiped out but severely mauled. I think by the end of it, there are sort of 50 soldiers who are standing from those who went into the front lines. They're able to kind of integrate soldiers who, like sort of rear area duty soldiers, like cooks and clerks and the like, to kind of build up the battalion. But to all intents and purposes, despite the fact it fought very bravely and it was kind of had been very well regarded for its bravery at the action of Second Ypres, the battalion itself has kind of effectively been rendered non-combat capable, as were a number of other territorial force battalions within these divisions. And so what happens over the kind of the spring going into the summer and the autumn of 1915, the battalion actually forms a composite with other units to effectively just go on to line of communications duties. So the various different kind of logistical tasks that keep the British Army running, but are pretty unglamorous. And during this time, new recruits come in. Eventually these battalions split apart and regain their original identities. And effectively, they spend the majority of 1915 kind of doing these tasks, really, until early 1916, when the 56th Division is reformed and the Rangers join its 168th Brigade.
A very brief history. Now, my furry assistant has now returned and he's now sitting on top of my questions. But
He
fortunately,
is a very handsome, I should add, he is a very handsome four-legged friend.
it is very, oh, in fact, she's called she. So
I
probably,
apologize.
sorry. No, don't worry. She'll take it out on me later. So she's now gone. So, right, organizational culture. You see, we don't really have much organizational culture at this end. And sorry, the tails on it. So anyway, being a professional and moving on, how does the organizational culture and leadership within the Rangers and also their parent division, which is the 28th Division, which you've mentioned already, how do these two firstly work together and how do they influence adaptation and performance in battle?
You see, this is a really fascinating question, but it's also quite a difficult one to answer. And the reason for this is actually there's fairly limited available records and data that really gives you that insight into what the battalion is like. So there are a number of first person accounts from members of the battalion during this period. Typically, as with many letters from the front line in the First World War, what they don't tend to talk about very often is the kind of the quality of the training they received or how cohesive a battalion they feel like they're part of. Very often, I'm all well. The weather's miserable. Can you send me some safety razors? And that's kind of very much kind of how many of these conversations take place. So It's so very often it's in terms of kind of trying to identify an organizational culture for the battalion is often quite is quite difficult to get at. There's a little bit more, I think, certainly sort of as after they've left the 28th Division and they're part of firstly as a part of the composite battalion, and then when they're on line of communications duties back again as the Rangers, where you get some insights into kind of how they're approaching things. And certainly their kind of approach to training is very rigorous. You know, when they're not on line of communications duties, they're undertaking company level training. And what we're then seeing from the personal accounts is talking about, you know, runs on the beach by the tarpals, you know, undertaking training exercises, practicing attacks on trenches, sending various different officers to various specialist schools like sort of grenades, bomb throwing, all of those kind of things. And that sort of information is kind of very absent from that kind of early periods with the 28th Division. And I think there's quite a sensible reason for this, which is effectively the battalion, having spent that time with GHQ, as we've said already, very much kind of then goes straight into the thick of it. And actually, their opportunity for training is really very limited. So, as I said, before joining the 28th Division, they'd been able to kind of enjoy 44 days of training behind the lines. Between the with throughout their time with the 28th Division, they only actually spent 6 days in training throughout that kind of 4 month period. And so I think there's actually very little opportunity for them to kind of really develop, because so often what they're having to do is to kind of organize themselves in sort of small fatigue parties, you know, no more than a company and often much less than that. And just do the kind of the physical duty of serving in the trenches and kind of moving supplies and all of those kind of things. So what culture there is was probably very much stamped down simply by the fact that they're very often having to organize themselves as very kind of small individual formations. And so it's quite difficult to kind of get a handle on what it was like at that time for the battalion and what that cohesion potentially looked like. I think with the 28th Division, it is interesting. And I think there'll be an opportunity later to kind of almost do a bit of a compare and contrast between the 28th and 56th Divisions. But I think what's really noticeable within the 28th Division is that there is a culture very much of sort of being on the spot, doing tasks as they're assigned to you. But during this time, the 28th Division is very much acting in a reactive capacity. You know, they're not it, unlike so. I mean, Edmonds, the sort of official historian, talks about the British Army in 1915 as being comprised of two different wings, an offensive one and a defensive one. And the Rangers, and by extension the 28th Division, are very much part of this defensive wing centered around Second Army in and around the Ypres salient. Most attacks which take place are fairly minor in nature, usually no more than kind of a division in scale. And the kind of the big significant action they take part in is the big defensive action at Ypres, which is kind of really typified by almost kind of brigades and a series of brigades and battalion actions, which are generally trying to reclaim territory or hold off the German offensive for as long as possible. And that's very typical of the kind of the 28th Division's experience. So that but those kind of opportunities to kind of really develop a culture, really kind of develop an ethos are very limited by their circumstances and the availability of the time they have. So we've talked a little bit already about kind of the limited training time the Rangers had. Having looked at other battalions, both territorial and regular, within the division at this time, it's pretty much the average. There are, you know, very few units are getting any significant amount of time to be able to kind of undertake training and to kind of have that rest. It's very much a case of fatigues, periods in the front line, short period of rest, repeat, rinse, repeat, as they kind of go through that process. And so I think it's very difficult for them to kind of develop an organizational culture in some respects. Certainly if you compare them to the divisions that will come in terms of the kind of the Kitchener divisions, who have spent this kind of huge lengthy period of time in training. They often have these very strong sort of regional affiliations, and they kind of almost have this sort of out of the, you know, out of the box ethos, which they're able to kind of take forward with them. Likewise, the pre-war regular divisions based in the UK, they've often, you know, these are people who have served alongside each other for a long time. And while training in the pre-war British Army was very ad hoc in nature very often, there is this kind of familiarity and way of acting, which I think really helped carry them through. The 28th Division and by extension, the 27th Division, which is formed around the same time, just really don't get that opportunity to do that. They're very much thrown into the thick of it very quickly. And there are other kind of circumstances which really kind of which don't help. They have a lot of sickness within the division. Some of that started in the UK. Their existing training camps were, you know, deluged for much of sort of November and December of 1914, which didn't help. They then go to France, where they're in equally unpleasant conditions, and then eventually in Belgium, and again in really, really horrendous kind of frontline conditions. And so it's not really surprising that with the kind of significant amounts of sickness, the very ad hoc nature of these formations, culture is really difficult to kind of pull together into, and it's very much relying on what was there pre-war, certainly in terms of the kind of things like the field service regulations and the emphasis of the kind of the man on the spot and kind of delegating responsibility to the person closest to the action, which worked very well in colonial campaigns and has got its place on the Western Front as well. But actually, in terms of kind of operating as a division, it's not ideally suited. Yeah, it was a tough time for them, to say the least.
Yes, yeah, I think that's very, very true. It is pretty ghastly period with all these territorial units stuck in mudfield trenches with very little sort of idea of what to do, which brings us neatly on to the next question about looking at sort of knowledge transfer in war. So what role did different forms of knowledge transfer, I'm thinking sort of top down, bottom up or horizontal, play in how the Rangers began to adapt and learn to fight and survive on the Western Front?
Yeah, absolutely. So probably first and foremost, I'm sure many people will be familiar with the terminology, but just to kind of give a quick definition, just so we're all singing off the same hymn sheet as such. So with kind of top-down knowledge transfer, what we're often talking about is kind of learning which is being directed from above, and usually by senior influential civil or military figures within a particular armed force. So that could be the BEF, that could be the British Army more broadly, but that can also percolate down to kind of division and even brigade level. The kind of the reverse of that then is bottom-up learning. So that is when sort of learning is being driven back up the hierarchy, and is usually based off the experience of various different subordinate units. And then finally, you have this concept, a relatively new concept. It's been around probably for about 15 years, so it's not really a new concept at all, but this idea of kind of horizontal learning. So this idea of knowledge being disseminated between different peers within a kind of a particular organizational structure. So taking those kind of three elements of knowledge transfer together, I think you see elements of all three, certainly within the 28th Division and within the Rangers, but then also more broadly across Second Army. So to put some context into this, Second Army and their actions in 1915 was the subject of my dissertation. So some of this will kind of bring you some of that broader learning from that as well. So essentially, in terms of that kind of top-down learning, then what we're starting to see is the development of doctrine, official guidance and training, which is being kind of percolated through the British Army, through the BEF, and then down to its individual units. Things like the kind of stationary service series and things like that really won't kind of take off until the end of 1915 and more particularly in 1916 as well. But we are starting to see some of that coming through. So particularly things like translated documents from the French and German Army, which are then being shared out to from the BEF to Second Army, and then being kind of pushed through the kind of the hierarchy into the various different corps commanders and down to the individual divisions. What's clear is that some of that communication is taking place, but very often it's not documented, certainly within battalion war diaries. And there is a kind of a sensible reason for that. You know, you've got a lot of information to kind of record and, you know, and to detail. Writing down, oh, by the way, we received this particular pamphlet on this particular day, probably just doesn't kind of enter, you know, doesn't come onto the radar of your average adjutant in 1915, to be quite honest. So we have evidence that we know that this information is kind of certainly being taken through to the brigade level. It's highly unlikely that then that's where it's staying. I think that information is being passed on. It's just very often it's not being recorded. On the flip side of that, we were also starting to see information kind of being driven back up the chain of command as well. So very often this is in the form of things like after action and lessons learned reports. And we see examples of this both within the Rangers War Diary, but also in other battalion and brigade and divisional war diaries for the 28th Division during this period. So I think after action reports and lessons learned reports are quite interesting, because while that information is being driven back up the chain, it's also in its own way, but also being kind of directed and dictated by senior officers as well, and by the army more broadly. So the second part of the field service regulations go into some detail about what kind of information you should be recording. It doesn't tell you how you should do it, but it tells you the kind of things you should be thinking about sharing back with your chain of commands. And so you start to see this, but it's very much done in an ad hoc fashion pattern. So, and it's usually on the back of being requested by a senior commander as well. So if we go back to Second Eve, for example, the Rangers, despite being so heavily depleted, they are asked to kind of complete some personal statements from key officers who are serving in the battalion that time to kind of feedback that information into the kind of the division's wider lessons learning program. What's really interesting is that while those documents exist within the Rangers War Diary, they don't appear in the official report that's pulled together by the 28th Division. So why that is the case isn't particularly clear. Maybe the Rangers' own documents just weren't produced in time. And again, that's understandable given mauling they'd gone through, and perhaps that information wasn't available in time for the report to be completed. Possibly it's because when you're looking at that kind of wide range of information that was coming back into the division, maybe they're kind of the lessons they were identifying weren't as useful as maybe other units were. And very often, a lot of these lessons learned reports are often quite narrative in nature. So what they're telling you is what happened. What they're not always telling you is why that matters or what lessons you can take away from that. Certainly in the case of the documents prepared by the Rangers, it gives a clear indication of what they did, but it doesn't really go much beyond that. And that's true of a lot of documents that go into the 28th Division. Looking more broadly across the BF in this time, there are some really interesting examples of battalions kind of coming back and saying, this didn't work, we should be doing this differently, and this is what we'd recommend to do. But such kind of conversations are quite few and far between, and certainly quite rare within the 28th Division itself. And then I guess the final element of that then is the horizontal learning aspect. So certainly there is some evidence within the 28th Division's War Diary of having things like conferences where brigadiers either bring their battalion commanders together or the divisional commander is bringing his brigadiers together to kind of talk through what he wants to do and having that opportunity to kind of share learning between each other. The problem with that is while we know some of these meetings take place, very often we don't know the subject of what's discussed. So that's when we kind of enter the realm of conjecture of actually how useful those informations were. Was it very much the case of the divisional commander just saying, I want you to do this and I want you to do it in this way, or was it a more collegiate atmosphere? We just simply don't know very often. More useful and kind of more tangible in terms of the Rangers' experience is that kind of shadowing opportunities they have of working alongside and serving alongside their regular counterparts. So we know, for example, both from the Battalion War Diary, but also from some of the kind of personal accounts that survive as well, that they spend a lot of time with the 2nd Battalion of the Cheshire Regiment. And that is perceived to be a really useful experience with them. From what you can gather, the Cheshires really looked after them and took the time to kind of spend time with their territorial counterparts and to kind of share their experience and knowledge. Bearing in mind, they'd only been in trenches a few weeks longer than the Rangers had been as well. So the quality of that information, I think, is open to debate, but certainly there is that dialogue which is taking place, and it's certainly very much appreciated by the Rangers. There's also evidence to suggest that sort of individual officers within the wider brigade are being sent to shadow other units, either very often the 27th Division, who had kind of again preceded them in the trench by a matter of weeks and were serving in a similar area, but also with some of the divisions that have been out there since 1914 as well. So there are definitely opportunities for kind of that individual learning and then being able to kind of share that back within their home units. But again, very often these aren't being formally reported. So again, it's very much kind of open to interpretation, actually, how what was being shared and how useful that information is. So I think in sort of summary, if you like, there is evidence that all of this kind of knowledge sharing is taking place. But very often what we don't know is the exact detail of that and actually how useful that information actually was.
Yes, no, it's a fascinating area, and I agree that it is difficult sometimes to work out how people do learn. So coming on to that issue, so from the experiences and training approaches of the two divisions that the Rangers are part of, that's the regular 28th Division in 1915, and then the territorial 56th Division in 1916 and throughout until 1918. How did these units vary in their approaches, and how did they draw lessons and disseminate them down?
No, absolutely. So I think there's some interesting similarities between both units, but there was also some very clear differences as well. And I'll kind of go into that first before kind of diving into some more of the details. So as we've kind of mentioned already, the 28th Division are very much NATOC formation. They're quite lucky in some respects. Their divisional commander, Edward Bulfin, was one of the stars of 1914, a very highly regarded brigadier. However, he'd been injured at the end of 1914 at the First Battle of Ypres and had quite a severe head injury, but then was recalled to kind of command the 28th Division within a matter of months. Subject to conjecture, personally, my kind of view would be I don't think he should have been anywhere near a division on the front line. I don't think he was physically well enough. And eventually he will lose his, he'll, he goes on sick leave, which is kind of polite way of being told he was sacked after the Battle of Loos. And very fortunately, unlike many of his contemporaries, he did get the opportunity to actually serve again. He did a fantastic job with the 60th Division in Salonika and in the Middle East. Sorry, not the Middle East, the Near East. And then went on to become a corps commander. And again, so he had the opportunity to kind of really show his stuff once he'd had time to recover. But certainly, he's not at his best in 1915. And I think that was to be something he later reflected on himself, but certainly is apparent in some of the records by his staff at that time. Speaking of the staff, one of the challenges that was faced by the 28th Division and likewise by the 27th Division, which was being raised at the same time, is, as we've said already, you're bringing in lots of individual battalions from across the British Empire and trying to form new brigades from those units. And the approach to this is very different. So like in the 27th Division and in the 29th Division for that matter as well, but go to Gallipoli, there seems to be an attempt to kind of almost create a bit like a sort of a, if you like, a proto-PALS style brigade, where you're kind of bringing different battalions based on either a shared geographical location or kind of a shared heritage. So for example, in 27th Division, the 80th Brigade is formed from rifle battalions and light infantry battalions. There's also a Scottish and an Irish brigade within that as well. And there's some evidence to suggest that they actually refer to themselves as the Irish Brigade and the Scottish Brigade within that, despite neither brigade being highly Scottish or Irish for that matter. By comparison, the 28th Division sort of gets the short end of the stick with this, which I've never quite been able to get to the bottom of why. So they kind of end up with a brigade that's kind of broadly northern, and I use the term quite loosely. Again, another one which is broadly from battalions drawn from the southeast, but again, not very clearly. And then the unfortunate sort of the second brigade, if you like, is, I think if you were being charitable, you might call it the kind of the East and West Brigades, but effectively it's just whoever was left. And you get a real mishmash of units. Likewise, the brigade staffs themselves are almost entirely from staff who have not served on the Western Front. And that's a deliberate decision. So if you look at kind of Thomas Snow, who's the divisional commander of the 27th Division, when he's called by Kitchener and said, I want you to leave the 27th Division, he's told very explicitly, you can have whoever you like as an aide-de-camp, but actually for your brigadiers and your brigade staff, you've got to pick people who aren't already in France because we need them there. And so the result of that is there isn't a huge amount of institutional knowledge. Well, I'll rephrase that. There's a huge amount of institutional knowledge for the British Army, and these are experienced officers and well-regarded officers very often as well. But what they don't have is that experience of service in the First World War in the front line. On the Western Front. And that certainly has a knock-on effect. And most of those brigadiers are gone within a matter of months, either through sickness or because they've been relieved and moved on. And that's also true for a lot of battalion commanders as well, unfortunately. By the time you get to the 56th Division, there are some similarities in the sense it's a division, although it's kind of built on the bones of the old 1st London Division, it's still very much an ad hoc division where you're kind of bringing together these kind of various dispersed territorial battalions from across the Western Front and bringing them together under new structures. Perhaps the significant difference, though, is the level of experience. So the 56th Division's divisional history refers to them as being veteran battalions. And I think that's probably a little unfair because I think a significant number of those battalions would, of the personnel within those battalions would have been relatively new recruits, but each of them would have had a core of veterans by this stage, and particularly in their kind of senior leadership. And that is a significant difference between the 28th and the 56th Divisions. Likewise, the brigades and divisional staff they're experienced. Most of them have seen frontline service. A number of them have also seen service within the staff on the Western Front already. So it's and Hull, who's the divisional commander, is a classic example of someone who arrives on the Western Front in late 1914 as a battalion commander, then commands a brigade in the front line, and now leads a division. So the level of experience by comparison with that kind of direct applicable knowledge of the Western Front is quite significantly different. The other thing within it, though, I would say as well, is actually just the amount of time the divisions have as well. In the case of the 28th Division, most of their battalions are back in the UK by early November. There's then a period of leave. You've got to remember some of these men will have not been home for the best part of a decade, you know, for battalions that have been out there for a long time. So there's a period of leave where people get to see their families. They're then being brought together. They're doing some very kind of quick training, again, very much focused around things like drill and fatigues and kind of building up that strength before going into the front line, and within a matter of days, kind of landing in France and then being in the front line as well, and having no real time to kind of gel as a unit. By comparison with the 56th Division, they get the best part of almost 4 months, really, before they see any kind of significant frontline service. And even then, it's primarily in terms of just holding trenches, because what they're actively preparing for and developing is for the upcoming offensive on the Somme. And so what you notice is there's a much, much clearer approach to training and knowledge sharing. So within the 56th Division, within days of it kind of coming together, a memorandum is pulled together, which kind of states very specifically what Hull is expecting from his battalions in terms of training and how that's going to take place and what things he wants to cover. There's a huge emphasis on of both offensive action, but also being able to take and hold objectives as well, which had been consistently the big issue that to the British Army in 1915. There's also kind of a real emphasis both on kind of individualized training, so skill at arms, physical fitness, you know, cleanliness, all of those kind of things, but then also collective training, so particularly battalion, company and brigade level training as well. And the nature of that training also changes quite significantly. So it begins as being kind of, it becomes increasingly specialised. So you're not only in terms of developing specialists, so developing people who are mortarmen, developing, you know, machine gun skills, developing grenadier skills, but also kind of the nature of the kind of the operational training they're undertaking as well. So certainly in the kind of the run-up to the Battle of the Somme, the division and its individual battalions and brigades are not only kind of undertaking these incremental practice attacks where they start off at company level, then battalion, then brigade, but they're actually often attacking practice trenches which are based off the objectives that they'll be attacking on the 1st of July. None of this was around in 1915 with the 28th Division. So there is a really stark contrast between the two. Now, some of that is absolutely having the time and the space to be able to do it. And I don't think we can discount that at all. And I don't want to be kind of too critical of the 28th Division as well, because I think they were doing the best that they could within the circumstances. And they had some very talented officers within that unit who will go on to do great things. But what they don't have, which the 56th Division had, was that kind of that real hard core of veterans who could, you know, who knew what the score was and knew how to fight a modern war and how to fight a modern division. So taking those two things together, they are very different formations. It's unsurprising that then you also see that similar change in the Rangers as well. And as they kind of, they're exposed to those kind of two very different organisational cultures.
So let's look at how the Rangers learnt. Now, were they innovators or adapters? And how did that adaptation, how did that way of learning contribute to the British war effort? And what does it tell us about military learning?
Yes, several very interesting questions, which I'll do my best to answer. Again, it's useful to just kind of think about what we mean by innovation and adaptation as well. So innovation, I mean, there are lots of different definitions to this. The one I kind of prefer for innovation is this idea that innovation brings about major change, whether that's new doctrine, new structures, new technology. And so very often this is weighted towards larger formations very often, because actually to be able to kind of give that time and the resources to be able to do that, you need a bigger structure to be able to do that. It's often quite difficult to do in a company. It's much easier to do in an army by comparison. And I think we talk about military innovation studies, and it's only off the back of kind of the Iraq War in particular as a kind of real growth in military innovation studies, very much kind of a buzz subject at the time. One of the things we kind of forget within that is that innovation to kind of quote from Theo Farrell here, is that kind of neither a necessary or sufficient condition for victory in of itself. Actually, innovation can help, it can make some really significant changes, but actually what you need is kind of broader change across an organization. And this is where adaption really comes in, which is this much more incremental change, and very often in response to experience as well. So there are various kind of competing ideas around this. So things like trauma learning. So, you know, a bad thing happens to you, you learn not to do it again. Or likewise compelled adaption, so you want to fight in a particular way, the environment doesn't allow you to do that, so you have to kind of think of a different way of doing things. And it's these kind of smaller incremental changes which often have the bigger impact in some respects. So thinking of that in terms of the ranges in particular, so from my kind of study of the documents available for them in this period, I've not really been able to find anything which kind of suggests they innovated in any practice themselves that I've been able to come across. Intriguingly, their kind of pre-war history is quite different. So they were one of the first battalions in the British Army to have a machine gun. They had a long-standing argument with the War Office of whether they were allowed to fire it or not, but that's kind of by the by. But they had a machine gun for quite a bit, you know, sort of as early as the kind of, I think it was like late 1870s, if I recall correctly. So a kind of an old Nordenfeldt kind of thing. But again, willing to kind of embrace new technologies. They also had kind of a series of regimental colonels who were quite involved in some of the debates in the British Army at this time, particularly through things like the Royal United Services Institute. But that doesn't seem to have then carried through into the First World War. But for the reasons I've kind of explained already, it's probably a little bit unfair to expect them to do that as well. Certainly, they seem to have been much more adept at adaption. I think that's also kind of broadly true for the British Army as well. So there are technological and strategic and tactical innovations throughout this period, and we shouldn't pretend that there aren't. So we see things like the introduction of poison gas, for example. That's, you know, that is genuine, as horrendous as it is, it's genuinely innovative. It's something which is new and is being done in a very different way to what it was before, and is making significant major change in how the army operates. Likewise, we also see some other technological changes, like the proliferation of bombs and grenades, the introduction of trench mortars, all of these kind of sorts of small minor technological things which actually have quite a significant impact in terms of how you're actually fighting on the Western Front. And the Rangers are very much part of this. They're imbibing the new training that comes through. They're adopting this themselves. And as part of their kind of individual brigades and battalions, they are also kind of driving some of that kind of broader change as well, and kind of pushing that knowledge back up the chain of commands. So within I'm trying to think which division it is, and I might get this wrong, but one of the things they always say, it's been a while since I've looked at this, but one of the things which is quite interesting is that initially there's this view that what you really want is to have a brigade bombing platoon. So all of your bombers in one place who will lead your attack, who will break open the front line, which will allow the rest of the brigade to get into the front line and complete their objective. The feedback that really comes back up from the training of this is actually it just kind of diffuses that knowledge the opposite, it concentrates that knowledge too much into one organization, which, you know, puts that at risk. But also means then as they take casualties, they're not able to, that knowledge can't then be shared within broader battalions. And actually what happens is if on the basis of that feedback, they break up these individual platoons, they put these bombers back into battalions and also increase the number of bombers within each individual battalion as well. So the Rangers are very much part of that conversation, that debate. There's also another example from the 56th Division as well, where the division pulled together a report, which is meant to go back to their second line units, although by this stage it was probably their third line units, to be quite honest, to about what training is useful to give to recruits before they come to the front line. So the idea being they're the best prepared they can be before they hit the tarpals and before they hit the 56th Division. And that document is actually kind of co-designed with the brigade and battalion commanders within the 56th Division. It's not kind of a centrally designed document. It's something which very much takes formal written feedback from these individual battalions and brigadiers, battalion commanders and brigadiers, telling the division what they need from their recruits. And then that is kind of collated and pulled together by the division and then subsequently then sent back to the reserve units in Britain to be able to kind of really give them that, you know, kind of give them the best possible opportunity to train before entering the rest of the front. And so I think it is fair to say it's one of these kind of slightly challenging things in the sense that to a certain extent, the battalion didn't have that much agency in their decision, you know, in their ability to either innovate or adapt. Very often, you know, this information is being provided to them and they're being expected to kind of either train or to organize themselves in relation to this guidance. But nevertheless, there are these opportunities to kind of be also be able to kind of pull that, you know, pull that information knowledge and put it back into the division and by extension then share that more broadly with the British Army as well. And that's certainly something you see more broadly, certainly across the 56th Division, but also more broadly across the Army at this period as well.
And my final point would be, where can people learn more about your work?
Well, this is a very good question. I do with great difficulty would probably be my first answer to that. So if you do still happen to be on X, I do have an account on there. I'm not on it very often at all, but it does have some of my previous research, and particularly projects I call the Battalion Census Project, where I was looking at the demographics of the British Army based off the 1911 census, and just really seeing what regimental culture and identity look like in that period. So if you search under hashtag Battalion Census, there are pages and pages of graphs and data and information about different regiments across the British Army, and you're more than welcome to look at. There is also there's a journal paper from the County Offaly Archaeological and Historical Society about the Leinster regiments, which again is available on their website, and you're more than welcome to look that up. I found it a really interesting project to be part of. And then, of course, London Pride, fantastic project to be part of, and that will, you know, and I mean, Tom, I imagine you'll be able to tell them much more detail than I will be about that, but at some point in the future there is a paper based on the 12th Battalion, based upon 12 Rangers, which goes into this in much more detail and probably much more coherently as well, I imagine.
But there you go. I can say it is much, it is a very good paper, and I enjoyed reading it, and it will be out in paperback for office and home use probably sometime at the tail end of 2025, knowing how these things go. So it is on the way, but again, the joys of doing a project like this is huge. But yeah, it's a good paper, and I think it'll be well worth doing, well worth reading when it comes out.
Oh, thank you.
And on that bombshell, Mark, thank you very much for your time.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Tom.
Cheers.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.